You've landed Inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello again. Another great week on Launch Street. Tamara here. Happy holidays to everyone. Or at least the start of the holiday season, I guess. So today's conversation is all about communication, which I think is an essential element of innovation. We talk a lot about how to be more innovative and create ideas, but there's a second side to this marathon, which is how to communicate ideas, how to get buy-in. It is so important, in fact, that I have an entire method I call the language of innovation that I'm pretty sure is one of the most watched videos on our online toolkit. It helps you get buy-in fast, particularly when you're dealing with innovation. So let's talk more about communication. Today, we're going to talk to Lee Carter about how to convince others. She wrote this fantastic book, Persuasion, Convincing Others When the Facts Don't Seem to Matter. She is a top communication specialist, a sought-after speaker, television personality. She is an expert in finding the right language to promote a brand or to fix a company's reputation following a corporate crisis. I think our conversation is fascinating because it's not just about how to communicate clearly or concisely, but also how to speak the language of your audience. I think you'll appreciate this one. Let's dig in.
Lee, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to digging in on some communication and persuasion.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited about this conversation.
All right. So I'm curious to know, what's your favorite innovative brand or business and why do you love it so much?
So I've thought about this a fair amount because a lot of my clients come to me and say, we want to be the next Apple. We want to be an innovative company. And so I've thought about what does it really mean to be innovative a lot. And I think innovation to me is something that solves a problem that you didn't know you had. Mm-hmm. And so to me, the most innovative brand, and this is probably something that's not original, is Amazon, because I'm now able to spend my weekends with my family and enjoying my life, not running errands like I used to have to. Everything that I needed to do can just now get delivered. And it's really changed the game for me, and I think a lot of people, and they're constantly doing that. They're solving problems we didn't even know that we had. So I would say Amazon.
I love that the definition about solving problems that you didn't know you had, because I do think when we look over time, some of the greatest inventions that really changed our lives are ones that you would have never in a focus group heard a group say, oh my God, no, I totally need that. I totally want that. Like I bet you before kind of one click and Prime and all that, if you had said to me, if I were in a focus group, right, and you were asking me, what do I need? And someone said, oh, well, do you want your packages delivered within 24 hours? I'd be like, I guess, but I don't really care. I mean, 2 days is fine. Like a week is fine. I'm used to it. Like
totally.
You don't even realize it until someone gives it to you. And then the challenge with it, especially with something like Amazon, is now every other business I interact with, I expect to be as fast and as consistent and accurate as Amazon.
It's true. I mean, it's a blessing and it's a curse. And in some ways, like the environmental damage that's come along with it too. It's like, it's become so much less convenient now. We've got all these boxes, all this recycling and all of this stuff. So it's its own set of challenges that needs to be disrupted. And then I think fixed again, but our expectations have totally changed. And I know that I never would have told you that I needed to be able to buy toilet paper online.
Right. No. Or food. You would have been like, no, I need to feel the grapes. I can't possibly do that.
That's 100% the way it is. And then all of a sudden it happens and you're like, oh my gosh, I can just stay in my pajamas on Saturday until noon. It's amazing.
I will tell you, the other day, I've got two boys, they're 11 and just about 15. And it was a Saturday and I got up before them and I had done the grocery shopping. I'd done all of it. And they got up at like, I don't know, 7:30. And they said, what have you been doing? I said, oh, it's been a great day. I've gone grocery shopping. I've ordered the blah, blah, blah. And they're like, where, when? I was like, oh, I just did it all on Amazon. Like I didn't even.
It's so great.
It's like 7:30 in the morning on Saturday and I'd already run all my errands, to your point, in my pajamas.
It's the best. And as a working mom, it solved a huge problem for us.
because yes. now we're able to enjoy our families on the weekends in a way that we couldn't.
But to your point, I don't know that I could have articulated it in a solution mode. I might have said, I wish I had more time and I didn't have to spend so much time doing errands, but I couldn't have told you, here's how I want it solved. And I think for all of us innovators, that's the challenge, is to take what people say is today's problems, but figure out the solution geared towards tomorrow, which is what Amazon, I think, did so well.
It's so true. And it's like that quote from that Steve Forbes talked about, like, if you asked what they had wanted, they would have said a faster horse, not a car.
Right. Yes. Yes. Right. Totally. And yeah.
I think that's what innovation really gets at. Like, I don't think we were ever sitting there thinking, like, you know what? I really wish we had streaming music so I could have a soundtrack to my life.
Right. You know, right. And I don't think I needed 10,000 songs in my pocket when I guess it was the iPod, right? It was the first one that came out.
No.
Just to date myself.
Suddenly you had it and it was the most amazing thing ever. And those are the things that are, you know, I never would have said that I needed Uber. Like, taxis were fine in New York City. I got out, you know, wherever I was traveling, I could get a taxi without a problem. It's totally changed the game. Now I live in the suburbs and I can not have to worry about going out and having a few glasses of wine at dinner. I can not have to worry about my 15-year-old stepson in the same way that we used to have to worry about with drinking and driving, because he will take Uber. And it's amazing what's happened and how the game's changed as far as how we view transportation.
Yeah. But to your point, right, we wouldn't have been able to articulate that. So speaking of articulation, I am excited to dig into communication and persuasion. And, you know, for the people here who've listened to this podcast for a while, they know, or see me keynote or whatever, they know that I think there's kind of two sides to innovation. Side one is being more innovative and thinking differently about what's right in front of you. But the second side, which I love talking about because it just doesn't get enough airtime, which is where your expertise come in, is how do you get buy-in for those ideas and how do you communicate them in a way that gets people along for the journey? Because it's great to have a good idea, but it's a whole different thing to get buy-in, which is ultimately what you need to put it into action and move it forward. So I wanted to start with you high level and about, from your perspective, why is communication so important?
The number one thing that clients come to me and say is, if people only knew how great the product was, they would buy it. If they knew how good our company was, they wouldn't be saying this about us. If they only knew XYZ, right? And so the way I look at it is, you can have the best product, you know, the best service, you can have the best company, you can have the best innovation, but if it doesn't resonate, it's not going to matter, because either people aren't going to try it, they're not going to adopt it, they're not going to use it, they're not going to get comfortable with it. Because a lot of innovation makes us uncomfortable. When the first time that you thought about shopping for groceries online, you're like, well, I'll never do that for fresh produce, right? Until you experience it. So how do you communicate it in a way to people that's going to make them comfortable trying it? When you think about autonomous vehicles now, a huge game changer. It could totally change our lives as we know it. And if we don't communicate it in the right way, people are going to be afraid to let go of the control of the automobile, because how are they going to be comfortable with it? So much of innovation isn't just having the best product. It's getting people to understand what it is and getting them to want to try it. Because once they try it, then that's a whole nother thing. But it's hard to get people up that innovation curve into understanding. And so there's lots of models on how you can do it. And lots of people will say, well, you can get a few early adopters and you'll get the cascade effect. But, you know, that can be true. But I think it's really important that we communicate in a way that's going to make people understand what it is and want to try it early on. And that starts all the way with kind of trying to get capital up front. How do you communicate your idea in a way that just clicks with people?
Well, and I think some ideas are the Ubers of the world, and some of them are just a process improvement inside a company that somebody wants to pitch, you know, to those people that they need buy-in from. You know, so I think that kind of to your point, I think the communication around that innovation and getting them up the curve applies to really anything you're trying to get buy-in for that's moving the needle, that's changing behavior, that's getting people to think a little bit differently. I mean, communication is for everything, but I think that in particular, given what you're saying. My question to you is, and this is almost naive, but I'd love to hear your perspective on it. because I think oftentimes we think the idea should stand on its own. So whether we're pitching to management or to the customer in the marketplace, whoever it is, it's like, well, but this is so brilliant. Don't you see the brilliance? Mm-mm. Why is it so hard to go that tomorrow? No. Why is it so hard to get buy-in even when you have a great idea? Even then, it's still just as hard, right?
Yes. And I tell people that work with me on helping our clients communicate more effectively, I say, if they can't understand you, it's not their fault. It's yours. Mm. Your job, when you're trying to get, when you're trying to get your idea sold, when you're trying to get change to happen, when you're trying to get somebody to see your perspective, if they don't hear you, they're not doing anything wrong. You are. So if your boss, and you're trying to pitch a process improvement, is pretty comfortable with the way things are going, how do you communicate your idea for change in a way that's going to make them comfortable doing it? You know, we've worked with some really big companies who are trying to make innovations in big and in small ways. And change always comes with making people afraid and making people anxious. And so it's really hard to get people to change behavior and disrupt. And I think the real key to any good innovation is that it disrupts. And when you're disrupting, you're going to have to communicate in a way that's going to make people comfortable with it. So one example of a project that we worked on years ago was we worked with Microsoft after their Vista debacle, right? And they were really excited to be launching the next version of Windows, and it was going to be innovative, and it was going to be all of the bells and whistles you could ever imagine. And they were so excited. They had all these developers, crazy language around the innovations that were coming with the next version of Windows. And we tried all different kinds of messaging, talking about the product, describing the product specs and features and how great it was and how there was a bouncing, bouncing paperclip that was going to give you tips and all different kinds of things. There was all different kinds of things that we could have talked about it. And everybody said that we tested it with, from developers all the way down to just regular consumers to people in IT who were making purchasing decisions. They were like, I want to know one thing. I want to know that it works. Don't tell me it's innovative. Don't tell me, just tell me it's not going to crash my system and tell me that it's going to work and how it's going to work for me and fit into my life. And so what we realized is that you couldn't just sell it on features alone. You couldn't sell it on all innovation. You had to show where, you had to put it yourself in the shoes of the other person. You just had a terrible experience with Microsoft and they wanted to know that you've done everything to make sure that it just works. And that's not the message that Microsoft wanted to put out there. They wanted to be excited about it. So I think sometimes convincing others makes you step out of your comfort zone and say, okay, how do I communicate to this person? What matters most to them? And then how do I fit into that narrative? How do I get myself into their shoes? And I think that's the key.
You know, I really appreciate that. I think one of the things that one of the big mistakes that we make and what you're really talking about here is that we really are thinking about what's in it for us when we communicate. Not necessarily because we mean to, but because we're human and we're ego-based and that's what we do versus what's in it for them, which to your point is a big mistake, especially when you're trying to get buy-in or get someone to resonate with an idea that might change things a little bit for them, for you, for the company, for the marketplace, whatever. And I think that's a big mistake. What are some of the other big communication mistakes you see people make? And what are the other thing I want to get to on that is what is the impact of those mistakes?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that we can underestimate the impact of lack of empathy has. So I think, well, first of all, I'll just take a couple of steps back. I think the first and most important thing that people need to be clear on and when they're trying to communicate is what are you trying to accomplish? What is your vision? And oftentimes, I don't think that we're clear enough on what that is going into the conversation.
Right.
So is our job, when you're having a conversation, are you trying to get somebody to totally change their behavior? Are you trying to get them to consider things differently? Are they trying to get them to look at your company differently? What is exactly that you're trying to accomplish? Because I think oftentimes we'll just start talking without thinking about what it is that the other person's going to need to do on the other side. And that can be a big mistake. The second mistake I think people make is they don't understand what their weaknesses are and why, you know, what are their barriers and what are the obstacles to being heard? So if you're trying to get somebody to try something new, what are the reasons that might not happen? Are they comfortable with what they're already doing? Do they not know about you? Are they afraid of you? Are they afraid of that product? really understanding what that weakness is. Are you something that they've never heard of before? Are you something that's already in some another category and you're known for something else? Because I think understanding all of those weaknesses is really important, because often it's in those weaknesses that we find. So, and by that I mean, if you think about a perception of a company as being too small to do something, well, you could talk about it being we're small, but we're boutique, we're niche. You think about somebody who's too big to do something, it's like, well, you have the scale to make an impact. So I think it's really important, because in the back of our head, there's always baggage that goes along with everything that we hear. And so I think we have to understand, you know, what it is that people are hearing, how we might flip that on its head. So, you know, we work with autonomous vehicles, for example, and getting people comfortable with that. So what is the weakness of an autonomous vehicle? It's really that there's no driver, right? It's like there's no control.
Right. It's a lot of strength is also its weakness.
Exactly right. So what if instead of trying to just lean into the technology and talk about how innovative and crazy it was, you talked about actually what autonomous vehicles are, is they're the most experienced driver, because we're using data and all of these other kinds of things. And it's kind of like flipping it on its head, the whole experience. Instead of it being all about technology and whiz bang, you're now talking about it creates a disruption just in how simple it is. And I think that's another step that's really important.
I have a question about the barriers and obstacles before we keep going, because this is so good. And I don't want to go too far past without asking this question.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and maybe this is just my own experience, but I find that I think I know the barrier and obstacles that are on the other side of the table. It's going to mean they're going to have to change what they're doing. It means they have to pull resources from something else to give it to me. It means for the marketplace, right, they're going to have to change their behavior. And I'm asking them to do something they've never done before. But sometimes I also feel like we get it wrong, and it's actually our baggage that we're putting on somebody else when, you know, hey, maybe being small, they see as an advantage because they have a direct line to the leadership of the team versus a bunch of junior people. Or as in a consulting example, what is your advice in terms of how you communicate and uncover those things in that conversation? Because I do find that sometimes it's really us projecting versus what that, you know, person or customer on the other end is actually thinking.
Yeah, I think that's so, so important, right? I remember when I first started working a long, long time ago, and the way that we learned about our customers is very different than the way we learn about them today. We used to learn about our customers, but we would fall in love with them. Like I started in in financial services.
Back memories of like the segmentations we used to do, like empathetic Emma and sassy Susie.
Totally. That's exactly what I'm talking about. You knew what coffee they brewed in the morning before they turned on the TV show and watched their favorite people on one of a few channels, and they read their newspaper in print, and they got in their car and they drove and they did whatever errands, but you knew it and you cared about them. Now we're like, oh, I have that customer that doesn't care about coffee enough to actually get a good cup of coffee. They will just drink whatever. And there's so much judgment, right, in how we talk about people. Everything is politicized. And it's like, instead of really slowing down and saying, what really matters this person? What are they all about? We're judging them. And so that happens in negative ways, judgment. It can also happen in ways that you assume that you know what somebody else is thinking and what's important to them. And so I think part of the persuasion process, or part of what's so important about what I teach in persuasion, is I teach something called active empathy. And active empathy is really slowing down and understanding the person that you're talking to, whether it's a one-on-one conversation or whether it's a whole swath of customers that you're trying to change, and try to understand them in three different areas. The first is what I call behavior-based empathy, which is all about understanding why they do what they do. Why are they doing what they're doing? The second is understanding what I call values-based empathy, which is why they believe what they believe about the topic. And the third is about emotional empathy, which is about feelings. So why do they feel the way that they feel? And I think slowing down on those things is really important. So if you have the opportunity to talk to a huge customer base on that, or even a small customer base, it's important to spend time talking to people and understanding these different areas and why they do what they do. feel what they feel and believe what they believe about whatever it is you're talking about. If you're in a one-on-one conversation, it's important to be asking a lot of questions before you start doing a lot of selling and understand these different areas about what they feel, what they're doing, and what they believe. And so this can happen in lots of different ways, but you know, I'll give you an example and I talk about this some in the book. When we're talking about an innovative product in the diabetes space, this is something that we're working on. And we have a lot of judgment on people who have type 2 diabetes. We think that they've done this to themselves, that they could be healthier, that they could have a better diet, that they're obese, all these kinds of things. A lot of the medical professions will say, I just don't understand it. They don't take care of themselves. Why aren't they having better diets? Why aren't they doing exercise? If they won't do that, this is what's going to happen to them. And so when we were talking to the patients themselves, we had judgment going into it. Like, why wouldn't you just do what the doctor says? And it's simple math. Like, you don't have sugar. And when you do, you take your medicine and you'll be okay. You'll get better. But what you realize quickly is that their life has been completely changed. And that, so it would be a non-empathetic insight to say they're like too busy or they're not dealing or they're too lazy to exercise or whatever else. When you spend time really talking to these folks and understanding the why is that, we learned from one example from this person who said, you know, the thing that's hardest for me is that when I go to my granddaughter's birthday party, I can't have cake. Hmm. And if
Which
I do
you
have
out of
cake,
the ritual in the community.
Yeah. If I do have the cake, then I have to take a shot in front of everybody and they're going to know I have it. Mm. Now my granddaughter's got to know that I'm sick too and everybody's going to judge me. Suddenly you're onto something. You're like, wow, I just don't want everybody to know that I'm sick. I just want to go to my granddaughter's birthday party and enjoy cake.
Right.
Now that's something you can work with. If you understand that's their baseline, you can change how you communicate with them. It's not about diet and exercise. It's not about doing better. It's about, no, how can we help you live your life? How can you take care of your diabetes and still have cake at your granddaughter's birthday party? You're going to have a much better conversation. Then they're going to be much like more likely to adopt the thing that you're trying to get to adopt. And so I think it's just so important when we get ourselves in a judgment, when we think we know what we're walking into, to slow down and question, have better conversations, whether it's just talking to one of your customers or talking to, you know, many of them. I just think it's so important to understand why they believe what they believe, why they do what they do, and why they value what they value.
Well, and I really like how you're breaking down empathy to say, you know, look at the behavior, the value, and the emotional, if I got that right. Because I think we're told to have empathy, but we don't really know how to do it. I mean, it seems right. Like it should be something that's natural, and it is for some more than others. But
sure,
but to really take a step back and say, if I were in their shoes, what would I care about? And then the other thing I heard you say in that great example was you then, from a communication and persuasion perspective, really honed in on the one important thing, the insight that allowed you to resonate with that group, with that audience.
That's right.
Versus, I think, trying to communicate this blah, which is what a lot of us do, hoping that something sticks. But picking the one thing, and that one thing can then trickle out to the other parts of their life. But to find that one insight that the person across the table from you or that consumer, you know, that you're trying to sell to, that you can really, that's the invisible string that can get you to them.
Exactly right. I think once you have this empathetic insight, for the most part, we all naturally have empathy. I mean, 99.9% of people have the ability to have empathy outside of like sociopaths and psychopaths.
Aside for that certain sect of people.
Right? It comes naturally, but it comes naturally to us with people who are like us.
Yes,
it doesn't
right.
come naturally.
Because they're easy to understand.
Exactly right. So you have to slow yourself down. You're talking to somebody who's not like you. And in persuasion, that's often what you're trying to do. You're trying to convince somebody who doesn't know anything about you, or you're trying to convince somebody who has a totally different opinion than you do to try it, to do something different. And so you have to get curious. You have no choice because they're not like you. So you have to slow down and do this. So once you've done that, and really slow down and understand why they feel the way they feel, why they believe what they believe, why they do what they do, then you can come up with this idea of a master narrative. One thing that you need to stand for, and a few things that stand underneath that.
You know, the thing that I find really interesting about this is, you know, I think we talk, there's a lot of buzz around clarity and vision. But what I'm getting out of this conversation that I'm personally finding very helpful, and I know all of us on Launch Street are, is this idea of really having that, not just empathy, like that person comes from that perspective, but really going, okay, not only does that person come from that perspective, but I'm going to accept it and embrace it and understand how to connect to it. Versus what I think a lot of us do in communication, which is, all right, Lee, like I get you come, so you live in New York, I live in Denver, I get you have different weather than I do and you're different, so that's fine. But that's different than me saying, hey, I totally get why, like, you know, you behave the way you do because you're in this different environment and really embracing that. I don't know if my analogy mm-hmm. made sense, but you know what I mean.
Totally. I think it's just, you know, empathy doesn't mean endorsement. It doesn't mean you have to like yeah. it, but it mm-hmm. does mean you have to understand it.
I love that.
And understanding
it doesn't mean endorsement.
Yeah. And I think that's like, you know, underneath it, if you're trying to persuade somebody to try something new, or if you're trying to persuade somebody incredibly difficult that's political in nature too, to have empathy for them does not mean that you believe the same way they do. It does not mean that you even have to like it, but it does mean you have to slow down enough to understand it. And once you do, then you can start changing their minds. Then you can start moving the needle. Then you can start connecting. Because all of this is about creating a meaningful connection. That's how persuasion happens. That's how, you know, everything, the light goes on when you're trying to get somebody to try something new. That's where it all happens. And, you know, and once you're able to do that and you get this idea of a, you know, of a master narrative, you know, that's the thing. Like, we want to find the thing that you're going to be known for. And all decisions happen mostly when we're not in the room. And so if you don't make it simple and something that resonates with them and is in their language, they're not going to remember it. It's not going to stand out, and it's not going to, you know, change isn't going to happen. And so I think we have to keep that in mind too, as we're developing our story. It's not just about a laundry list of all the good stuff that we offer. It's not a good big laundry list of all of our features. It's not all of the great stuff that we can talk about. It's what is the one thing? Because we want them to remember it when we're not there.
I want to ask you two questions. First of all, because I don't want to be assumptive, when you say master narrative, what do you mean by that?
So master narrative, I describe as the one thing, the one part of your one story that you're going to leave behind. In politics, it's that one thing that we all know. With Obama, it was hope and change. With Trump, it's make America mm-hmm. great again. With Nike, it's their tagline, just do it. With, you know, we all have them, whether we like it or not. You know, the mom that's in the PTA group is like, she's the one that's just going to get it done. Don't give him the project because he's never, you know, he's not a good team player. We all have that sort of master narrative around us individually and as brands and as products. We want to control that and own it. And so you want to be able to come up with what is the one thing when you're done with this conversation that person's going to remember about you? What is it? What is that one thing that you want them to remember about your product, your innovation, your company? Not a lot of things, not all of your proof points, but what is your story? Is it, I'm going to make your life better because of X? But you've got to find something that is going to be that one thing that sticks. That's what the narrative
is. Got it. Okay. I thought you were heading that direction, but I wanted to make sure, and I love the way you described that. You said something else that I found really fascinating, gave me a flashback to a moment when I was vice president of this consulting firm, and I was on the giving a presentation to the board, and then I left. And one of the board members who ended up becoming this wonderful mentor and champion of mine said to me, Tamara, you need to, because I was insecure at the time. I was new to that position and that first board meeting. I was hesitant and a little bit reserved in my conversation. Mm-hmm. And later on, he said to me, Tamara, the real talk is happening when you're not in the room. So if you don't make a stand for yourself and make a name for yourself while you're in the room, believe me, the narrative that's happening about you when you're not there is not one you're going to like. And it kind of blew my mind, this idea that most of the talk about you happens when you're not there. And then you just said, decisions happen when you're not in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So will you talk a little bit more about that and how you make your narrative stick in a way so that when you're not in the room, it's what you want them to be saying about you. And my mentor kind of, he really drilled that into me about like, you own that room in the way you want to, so that when you're gone, that's the narrative they're listening to.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that. Cause it's just, when you said that, I was like, oh gosh, that brings me 20 years back.
Right. Well, it's funny because I think a lot of us have these kinds of career defining moments where you learn that. Because if you think about it, the moment when you do a search online, like I need to get a new pair of socks, what is going to make you decide to go with Spotify, iTunes Music, or Amazon Music? What is the difference? What is the thing that's going to make you remember one over the other? When you're at, you know, when you're at the grocery store and you're deciding which seltzer am I going to pick out? When you're, it's, there's something in your head that you're going to remember, like, gosh, I heard that one was Bigger Bubbles, or I heard that one is the sock that never falls down. I heard that one is the, and there's these things that just stick with you, right?
Right.
And so that's what we want to find. When you're trying to tell your story, what is that one thing that's going to be in a person's mind right at that moment of decision? So if you're trying to convince somebody to invest money with you, how do you, you know, like, how do you, what do you want them to remember? It's like, when I'm thinking about why would I invest in your startup versus somebody else's startup, I want that. That's what I'm talking about. You want the thing that's going to be ownable, distinctive, and make people go, I want that.
And I think that's part of the reason why it's so important that we're so clear and concise when we are in the room, because to your point, most of it happens when we're not there. I want to ask you a question from your book. And I told you offline before we kind of hit record that I love particularly the subtitle of your book, which is, so the book is Persuasion, Convincing Others When Facts Don't Seem to Matter. I love that. And I partially love it. And I don't mean to get into a political conversation, but I think that's the world we live in right now, where facts are really more juice for narrative, whichever narrative you decide you mm-hmm. believe in. Across the board, not just in politics, just kind of the world we're living in, where we all get to kind of quote unquote make up our own minds all the time. But one of the things you talk about in there with when facts don't seem to matter is knowing the language of your audience. And maybe we covered that in the beginning when we talked about what's in it for them, but what did you mean by that? Tell me more.
We're talking to influencers. We try to get inside baseball a lot. We talk a lot of jargon and we'll try to speak just like
yeah,
they can speak. And I don't always think that's the right thing to do. I think and that goes back to thinking about your big idea. What are you trying to accomplish? If your goal is to speak to people who are just like you, if your goal is just to speak to developers or just to speak to people who are really technical or financial advisors or doctors or whatever else, that's one thing. But I think it's just really important that you slow down and try to think of who it is you're trying to talk to, what you're trying to accomplish, and then speak in a language that's most relevant to them. Because you want, in many ways, to short circuit. All language comes with baggage. When you hear something, it triggers you. And so you're either going to say, like, I don't understand that. It sounds like something I want to hear. It sounds like it's for somebody else, right? Like, we're hardwired to make decisions really quickly. One of the things that's amazing about human beings is we are hardwired to recognize patterns. It makes things much more efficient. If you think that you're getting over 5,000 messages targeted at you a day, you don't even realize it because your brain just processes it for you. You recognize patterns, you pick up or you put down. You're either going to pick up something that you think is targeted at you or you're going to put it down because you think it's not. And so you've got to find ways to just get things recognized by other people. Now, when we talk about facts mattering and not mattering, you know, I don't know that facts ever mattered. And by that, I mean, we always have picked up the information that reinforces our existing beliefs and put down other things. But used True. To be yeah. that we didn't have the ability to get so many different sources of information. So we used to have trusted authorities, and that's where you would go to. Used to have that one person at the dinner party who was your encyclopedia. Now everybody has their own phone, so you can find information that contradicts each other. Like, we're just living in an age where there's so much more information at our disposal, and so it becomes harder and harder because we can live really tribally. We can live in a bubble of only reinforcing our existing beliefs, for that's not the way things used to be. And so I think it's really important when you're trying to communicate with somebody else, communicate in their language so that they're able to pick it up, recognize it, and examine it. Otherwise, they're just going to reject it outright. So if you're a liberal trying to speak to a conservative and you're using language that is really liberal based,
you're probably not going to make much progress. Like, for example, and I know we don't want to get into politics, but we worked on a project and it was for Head Start, really great program. But a lot of the language they were using at the time was like really heavily laden with legacy language from the war on poverty. They talked about welfare. They talked about a lot of things that conservatives just would reject. So as soon as they heard it's a welfare program, or if it was a spending program, or it was a legacy program for the war on poverty, they're like, reject. I don't even care what it is. Done. When we changed the language, instead of talking about that, we talked about investing in our youth. We talked about creating opportunities for all. We talked about making a level playing field. Same program, same stuff. Conservatives were on board. And so I think sometimes it's as important to just slow things down and say, how can I talk about this in a way that's going to reach them rather than trying to reinforce their own language?
So one of the very informal exercises I've been doing over the last year is when I get off stage, I'll talk to people in the audience. And I've been just kind of jotting down their language and the things that they say to me. And then I went, recently we were doing some website work, and I realized the language on our website was in no way the language that people were saying to me, who were my audience. They were the right people I was in front of. But our marketing did not match their language, kind of to your point. And we went through this whole exercise of kind of going through it. But what we really realized was that that jargon was our jargon in our little office that we use with each other. And while it's not wrong, it doesn't connect. But it was so fascinating to me to realize, as I was looking through my little notebook of language, that like none of that was what we were using.
Right, exactly. It happens all the time. It's such a good example. Good story.
Well, that's why why I appreciate what you're saying about, hey, like it, you may have the best intention and you're not wrong necessarily right in what you are saying, but if you're not using the language of the people you're trying to connect with, it's going to fall on deaf ears. And, you know, you were kind of talking about, we kind of reinforce what we already agree with. You know, we have this particular activating system, which is this filter, which only lets in what matches the external with the internal, because we have to filter, because we're inundated with information. So if we're not at least squeezing through that filter in some way, we're not even getting through at all, which is, I'm sure, kind of what you've seen a lot with communication is like, hey, that's great, but it's not getting through the filters.
Right. It's really true.
Okay. So, you know, I was talking a little bit about doing some informal research and just matching my language with the language that people were using to me. How do you test your brand's persuasive strategy and if it's working?
You know, if you're not going to hire me to do it and you're doing some informal mm-hmm. research, I think that the most important thing to remember is you have to stay curious. Our brains are amazing in how they function, but you cannot be both emotional and curious at the same time. And so you have to keep that in mind when you're trying to understand. You have to leave all of your predisposed thinking, all of your preconceived notions of how great your product, how great you are, and what that person thinks at the door. And so the way that you do this, and I talked to a couple of different psychologists, and I talked to a sports psychologist and a coach and somebody who trained Olympic athletes, and how do you keep somebody staying curious and keep them from getting emotional? Even in athletes, they would come to me as, how do you keep somebody from getting emotional? It's actually to get them to start asking. So what I tell people is, when you're going through this process, if you find yourself getting activated in any way, and by that I mean you can tell yourself you're getting a little bit short, you're reaching judgment, you're already trying to change their mind, slow down and start asking questions instead. Because I think it's really important that in the exercise of trying to understand what the other believes, that you're not trying to change their mind. You have to take those two ideas apart. So your job is to find out why they believe what they believe, period. It's not to change their mind in research. So you've got to ask the questions from a pure curiosity perspective. And if you find yourself getting triggered, you slow down and ask more questions. And I think you have to have a really clear roadmap. I think that you've got to be very deliberate, very well planned. And I always say that when you're asking questions, it's important to ask what I call the five whys. So when you ask somebody, so tell me what's most important to you when you are picking a soup. It's the flavor and the brand. I guess I always like to buy Campbell's. Well, why? Well, because I know every store has it and I've always liked the tomato flavor that they have. Well, why? Well, you know, I can remember when I was younger, my mom always used to make me tomato soup when it was cold and it was the first days of fall. And it reminds me of jumping in leaf piles when I was younger. Well, now you're onto something interesting. Mm-hmm. But it never happens in the first question. It always happens in the fourth or fifth. So when you're asking questions about why people believe what they do, slow down, ask why. And I always say it's the fourth or fifth why that's going to give you the insight that's going to be really interesting. That's where you need to live, getting underneath it.
This may sound like an odd question, but do you have any go-to questions as that first why question? And part of the reason I'm asking this is I find that sometimes people are curious, but they don't know what to ask. So they get stuck. So they move to answers. So what are some kind of favorite things that you go to get that why conversation started?
I'm a big fan of general questions and then digging into the why. And that's different in qualitative research and conversations than in survey questions. I think it's a very, you know, I think, and I'm sorry if I'm just sort of slow here. I want to make sure I answer this right, because I think what you ask is as important as anything. And part of it is really just about getting people comfortable talking.
Mm-hmm.
So do I have one question? In some ways, I think research is an art, so I don't know as though I could just tell you that I have one question. You know, in the book, I have a workbook, and I have a lot of questions that people can ask. So one of the things that I have you do is say, okay, so write down the message you're trying to communicate and have somebody read it or read it to mm-hmm. them. And I ask them, instead of asking what they think of it, I ask them to repeat back to me what they heard.
Interesting.
So you might have your whole message, you know, your paragraph about why your product is the best product or why your idea is the best product. And I, instead of saying anything else, I just say, tell me what you heard. Don't repeat back the exact message. What's your takeaway? Tell me what you heard. And then I ask, why does that matter to you? And does it? The other thing I think is important to ask is, after hearing that, is there anything that you're going to do differently? Why? Why wouldn't you? Why would you? And I think all of them need to come to wise. Is there anything that you learned that you didn't know before by what I just told you? And I think sometimes the biggest, when we're talking about what the best innovation is disruptive. When you talk to somebody about what they learned that they didn't know before, often you'll see that's where the disruption has happened.
I really like for all of us on Wall Street, just to pay attention to that question that you said, Lee, about does it matter to you? Does it even matter to you? Because I'm going to use your Campbell's example for a second. Like if you mm-hmm. asked me what soup you buy, I'd be like, oh, well, I always buy Campbell's. I know where it is in the grocery store. Well, why? Well, because, you know, they've got some flavors that I like. And then if you ask me, does that matter to you? I might then say, not really. I just happen to know where it is. Like if something else showed up there, I might buy that too.
So totally.
I think that question that you just said about, well, does that matter to you? Or why does that matter to you? Is a really important one that we often miss. So it's really, I like the way you frame that, because I think we sometimes get people down a rabbit hole too, and don't actually pull back to say, hold on, does any of this matter at all? Because sometimes it actually doesn't.
It's true.
Yeah. So I love that you said that. We are almost out of time. So before we get to the last question, I want to know, where can people go to learn more, get the book, connect with you?
Yeah. So you can buy the book Persuasion, Convincing Others When Facts Don't Seem to Matter on Amazon or wherever you buy, where you buy your books. You can connect with me directly on leehartleycarter.com or you can find me at Ms. Lansky and Partners.
I have two last questions for you, but this one I meant to ask earlier. I wrote it down. We didn't get to it. So I want to make sure to get it in here before we're done. When clients call you, what problems are they trying to solve?
So when clients call me, there's a few things that they're trying to solve, but they'll come to me presenting different symptoms. often it's the same few challenges. One is they're not standing out in the crowd. So it's a crowded marketplace. Nobody's buying their product. Why? It's a good product. We have the best offering. Nobody knows about it. Why? So that's about differentiation. The other thing that people come to us with is that they're misunderstood. It's like, if people only knew that we were good, or people only knew that this was awesome, and that's another challenge that people come to us all the time. It's the big misunderstood challenge.
So it was a little bit of a loaded question, but part of the reason I wanted to ask you about that is because I think we undervalue communication, or we pigeonhole it, and persuasion, we pigeonhole it into a place of like, I'm just trying to get buy-in for my idea. We don't, I kind of asked the question about impact in the beginning. And I think the problems that you're talking about are really big, important challenges that a lot of our clients and a lot of us on Launch Street face. And we kind of forget to go, oh, let me look at my communication for a second here and see if I'm being clear and have a vision and finding that master narrative that you talked about. It is amazing how much that can clean up and fix a challenge that we think is a sales problem, or, you know, whatever other problem we think it is.
Totally.
It's really just a communication problem at the end of the day.
That's true.
Communication is oftentimes at the crux of it, but we don't think to look there first.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. So final piece of advice for innovators on Launch Street who want to persuade more.
So I think that I'll give three pieces of advice. I think one is think big, really be clear on what your vision is, specific, know exactly what you're trying to accomplish. The second thing is stay curious, really get to know the person that you're trying to persuade. Stay very, very curious, practice active empathy. And then third, know your one thing. What is the one thing that you want to be known for that's going to make people just say, I want that, or I'm willing to try that?
That is a great piece of advice to end on. And I have to say, Lee, I love the active empathy. I think we talk about a lot about active listening, but we don't really take it to that next level of empathy, which is a whole kind of step, 10 steps above. So thank you. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.